From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 15th day of June 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk with Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities in Newmarket, Indiana, and Mike Barwinski of Louis Dreyfus out of Kansas City. Along the way, we'll hear from the state statisticians in Iowa, Illinois, Nebraska, and Indiana. And in our second half hour, on most of these stations and always online at willag.org, that's willag.org, we'll take a look at a Human Rights Watch paper on child labor practices in the United States. And it all happens right here on this Tuesday edition of the Closing Market Report. The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media.
Learned Seed Service supports agricultural programs as an additional service to its customers. Learned Seed Service is an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgrow seed products, including Genuity SmartStax corn hybrids, to farmers throughout East Central Illinois. Learned Seed Service, 217-497-2270.
In Chicago on this Tuesday afternoon, futures finished the day like this. The nearby July soft red winter wheat, $4.51¾, up a quarter. September at $4.67½, unchanged. December at $4.94, unchanged as well. July hard red, $4.78¼, a penny and a quarter lower. December at $5.07½, down 1½. July corn back in Chicago, $3.53¾, unchanged. September unchanged at $3.63. And December corn at $3.75, unchanged. March contract $3.88, down a quarter. The May at $3.97, down a quarter as well. Soy complex now, July beans, $9.49½, down 2 for the day. August at $9.35½, 3/4 lower. September at $9.20, down a quarter. And November beans at $9.15½, down 3/4. January futures, $9.25¼, down 1¼. July bean meal, $2.85.70, down $4.30. July soybean oil today, $37.81, up 42 cents on the afternoon. June live cattle futures, $90.05. 100 weight. A settlement price up 27½ cents. August live cattle futures, $88.60, 47½ cents higher. August feeders at $110.97½, up 55, and the September futures on the day at $110.97½, 55 cents higher. July lean hog futures, $80.12½, up 7½ cents. The August at $82.37½. August futures in Chicago finished up 60 cents on this Tuesday afternoon. You are listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. You can always find us online at willag.org. That's willag.org. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. Crude oil futures, July contract, $76.84 a barrel, up $1.72. July ethanol at $1.60½, 0.8 cents higher. August there at $1.60¼, up a penny. Natural gas in the July at $5.17¾, 17¾ higher. Heating oil or diesel fuel at $2.06¢, up 4 cents even. And the gold futures for the day at $1,233.20, up $9.90. That, of course, a settlement price. The Dow Jones Industrial Average just about 180 points higher at 10,370. The U.S. dollar down 0.52 at 85.98. And the CRB index today at 263.50 is 3.52 higher on the afternoon. Here's what the weather forecast holds for the Midwest. It says today and Wednesday will be the last of the bigger rain-producing shower days. There'll be thunderstorms along with that, and they'll be pretty widespread. The jet stream will shift northward later in the week, and into next week, that'll allow warmer temperatures and less rainfall. Totally dry weather not expected through Thursday, June the 23rd, but rainfall will decrease to an isolated to scattered shower pattern after that. Temperatures should be seasonable through the coming week, with many highs in the 80s, the low 90s. Wheat conditions will remain poor in the heart of the Midwest due to wet fields and additional rainfall through Wednesday. Summer, of course, grains and oilseed conditions will enjoy a great benefit from less frequent rain and the warm weather pattern, that is. We'll talk more about the agricultural weather forecast when we get to the bottom of the hour and have a discussion with Don Day of Day Weather out of Cheyenne, Wyoming.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Bob Baisdefer in Danville at 217-477-6016. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
It's a Tuesday afternoon. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities in Newmarket, Indiana, is on the phone line with us to discuss what happened in Chicago. Hi, Wayne. How are you?
Why, good afternoon, Todd.
Hey, you know, it's been a long time since I've seen corn unchanged, and it really didn't look like very much was happening today. Did that surprise you at all?
Not really. We've got a lot of things sort of at a Mexican standoff, we'll call it. We've got tremendous crop ratings here in the U.S. We've got plenty of moisture. If you look at the moisture map as far as how things are going, we're going to continue to have some rains here through the next few days. And then we're going to turn a little bit warmer, a little drier for a little while, which is exactly what all this corn crop needs. And, we planted most of it early. We got a lot of it in and looking good. And, and then on the other side of that, we have the Chinese bought a couple loads of corn this week. They're out on holiday. We look for a possibility that they might buy a little more. And the Chinese weather isn't ideal. And, of course, the Canadian weather is, instead of being warm and dry, it's cool and wet. And they're going to leave some acres unplanted with canola, wheat, and oats up there. So the Mexican standoff there sort of continued, but the crop ratings going up, being as high as they have been since 91, and basically scheduling a tremendously good crop to look at, it sort of held the corn in check against what the beans tried to do earlier today.
Yeah, we'll detail those crop ratings when we get done talking with you, and they include some good numbers, I suppose, for soybeans. Maybe planting was farther along than most had expected, 91%. Beans were off 2 cents. They had a bit of a wider training range than corn, but I suppose that was expected during the day. What do you see in the soybean complex?
Well, the first thing we see is a lot of people talking about some yellowing in the beans, a little extra moisture, a little bit behind on what they thought that we should be for this time, and a lot of places still saying they need to get some beans in the ground, and the ground is very wet, and they aren't being able to do that. But on the other hand, why we're seeing that, the beans are out there have made some, they're growing and growing well, even if we did drop a couple percentage points on the ratings that way. And, of course, the old beans are tremendously tight, Todd. Basis levels extremely tight. That way, and we don't have a lot of beans making it in the new year, but we do have a lot of beans coming on and quite a few acres of beans coming on.
Okay, then go to the big one. Take a look at oats. What a rally they've had.
Well, we have very, very few acres of oats. We've been short oats just because oats and wheat sort of tend to go along together as we go along the way. And when we got the announcement out of Stats Canada that that percentage of the oat crop probably wasn't going to get planted, we saw a lot of the fund traders that were highly short oats, and they've been liquidating. And, there's just not a lot of buy orders or a lot of sell orders just going to be come popping into a market that looks to be extremely short, and they got caught really bad.
Yeah, okay. So on that one, because there will be some people who are tempted. I was looking here. It looks like in November of 2009, they went to a high there of what, 298 and a quarter, and we're at 274 on a settlement price. Would you be wanting
I'd
to follow that higher?
I'd rather buy a put than buy a call at this point in time.
That's my question. I suppose
and,
that's it.
I guess to be careful about it, and I'm sure that the volatility factors are very high and will make the cost of a note call or put rather expensive, but we're getting in dangerous ground as far as thinking that the oats will continue to run.
That's what I wanted to hear about. Okay, and just for reference points, get this one. In June of 08, June 30, 08, the high for oats at 5, that's the lead option in July. This is July, 557. It was the high.
We remember that, and we remember that there was a lot of money made in oats on the way up, and there was a lot of people that forgot to to take that and bank that money, and a lot of it was lost on the way back down.
Well, that's the way it happens in the commodity markets,
yes.
Isn't it? Hey, one other thing. Did you listen to yesterday afternoon's discussion with CEPA, the Crop Insurance Professionals Associations?
I sure did. And one of the things probably that I don't think he caught on and you caught but didn't understand what was going on was when you were talking about when we were moving 3 to 4 percentage points and not understanding why that would
right.
hamper into an agent's paycheck 25% or more. What we're talking about is when it's said and done for all of the administrative costs for the everything along the way that the government allows the crop insurance companies basically anywhere from 16 to 18% for their administration and operating expenses that way. And with this additional $6 billion cut, you know, we already had a $6 billion cut in the 2008 Farm Bill, and what they're doing with this new contract is another $6 billion cut, and that'll move them down from, say, 17 down to take 4% off down to 13.
Right.
So that's 4 divided by 16 for your percentage, and, you know, that gives you your 20-25% that way. So that was one of the things, you know, so all of a sudden they're going to expect these insurance companies to pay all their overhead, their operating expense and their expenses on 75 cents on every dollar just in 1 year's time period differential.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that everybody is clear. Before I did that interview with the folks at the Crop Insurance Professionals Association yesterday, and Wayne didn't put me onto them, that was something that we picked up here at willag.org. I did write Wayne a note and said, hey, tell me what you're hearing from your side, because, of course, Wayne is our regular analyst, and we trust him to give us a straight scoop and tell us, because you sell crop insurance, what's happening. And then what I missed was, because I wasn't online, I didn't see you give me that correction during the program. You were listening and sent me an email that gave me the correction. I wanted to give you the opportunity to do that. So any other highlights out of it that we should cover before I let you go?
You know, and one of the things, and if you have a chance, call your senators or representatives too, because these massive cuts they are not good for rural agriculture, because they're going to be hurting a lot of jobs and that around the way, because as crop insurance agencies, if they aren't making money, they're going to cut back or quit doing some things and not be able to do a lot of things in your community for you. So, you know, these are things, it's not they aren't just totally getting rich there. They are cutting. They've cut us back $6 billion and another six. So this is a $12 billion budget cut in a small and not that large of industry.
All right. So up on the chopping block first, I suppose, is the SRA and the crop insurance
yeah.
agents, and then the next thing, if we're to believe what's coming out of Washington, are direct payments.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things, and they're really going after the agriculture budget because less voters. I mean, you know, so that's the bad thing. And there's a few things in here that we haven't really got analyzed well yet, but the agents will have incentives to drop their smaller clients and produce a portfolio of larger policies so they can negotiate a larger commission. And that's going to leave a lot of our smaller farmers sort of hurting for service. And the whole idea is not that everybody is supposed to be treated the same on this on a per-acre basis, and, you know, there isn't any volume discount for the large farmer. It is fair to everybody out there that grows an acre of corn, beans, or whatever for the insurance.
Okay, thank you so much, Wayne. We do appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you, Todd.
Wayne Nelson is with L&M Commodities in Newmarket, Indiana. You know, we talked about having a comment period for that SRA. That is a closed comment period, so you won't be able to do anything in terms of personally make that comment period. I think that comment period is closed and open only maybe to the 16 organizations or companies that actually sell crop insurance. So just to let you know where things stand in agriculture and Washington, D.C. this week, we're trying to keep you up to date as we possibly can here on the Closing Market Report.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a Tuesday afternoon. Yesterday, USDA released its weekly crop progress report. It showed by the week's end, 98% of the 2010 corn crop had emerged. That's 4 percentage points ahead of last year and slightly ahead of the 5-year average. Overall, 77% of the corn crop reported in good to excellent condition, up from the ratings last week and 7 percentage points better than the same time last year. Soybean producers had planted 91% of the nation's crop by the week's end. That's 5 percentage points ahead of last year, slightly ahead of the 5-year average. Double-digit gains were evident in Kansas, North Carolina, South Dakota, and Tennessee, where 10% or more of the crop was planted during the past week. Nationally, emergence for soybeans has advanced to 80% complete by June the 13th, 10 percentage points ahead of last year, and slightly ahead of the 5-year average. Above average temps promoted, of course, emergence across the region. Overall, 73% of the soybean crop reported in good to excellent condition. That's down slightly from the ratings last week, but 7 percentage points better than the same time last year. Winter wheat now by the 13th day of June. 88% of the nation's winter wheat crop was at or beyond the heading stage, slightly behind last year and 4 points behind the 5-year average. The most significant heading delays were evident in the Pacific Northwest and Montana, where continued cool temperatures have slowed crop development. Nationwide, 9% of the winter wheat crop was harvested, 2 percentage points ahead of last year, 3 points behind the 5-year average. Warm, moist, dry conditions throughout much of the week promoted harvest progress of 26 percentage points or more in Arkansas, North Carolina, and Oklahoma. 66% of the winter wheat crop reported in good to excellent condition, unchanged from the previous week and 22 points better than the same time last year. Now here are the statisticians from Iowa, Nebraska, Minnesota, Illinois, and Indiana with updates from their regions.
This is Greg Tayson, Director of USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service Iowa Field Office, with the weekly crops and weather report for the week ending June 13, 2010. Iowa farmers were waiting for drier conditions as heavy rainfall during the week totaled 2 inches or more in most areas and over 5 inches in several areas across the state. The large amounts of rainfall that fell in short periods of time have led to erosion, especially in fields that were tilled. Some ponding and flooding in low-lying areas has also been reported. The weather gave farmers little opportunity to continue with field work. Farmers are becoming concerned about when fields that have not been planted will dry, and spraying has fallen behind schedule with rapid weed growth starting to become a problem. Corn has been characterized as turning yellow in wet areas, while dark green and reaching heights of 58 inches in other localities. Soybeans are emerging nicely, but are becoming highly infested with weeds. Nearly all of the expected corn acreage has emerged and was rated 76% good to excellent. Soybean planting at 97% complete is on par with the normal pace, even though there is significant acreage left to be planted in the southern third of the state. With 92% of the soybeans emerged, 3 percentage points ahead of the 5-year average, soybean condition was rated 75% good to excellent. 55% of the oat acreage has headed ahead of last year's 28% and the 5-year average of 39%. Temperatures in Iowa for the week as a whole averaged 1.7 degrees above normal, and statewide precipitation was 3.22 inches, nearly 3 times the weekly normal. This is Greg Tayson reporting from the USDA NAS Iowa Field Office.
This is Brad Schwab, Chief Crop Statistician with the USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service Illinois Field Office, reporting on crop progress and conditions for the week ending June 13th. Another week of above-normal temperatures and rainfall covered most of the state. The week ended with only 2.8 days being suitable for field work, and topsoil moisture supplies were reported much wetter than the previous week, at 1% very short, 1% short, 51% adequate, and 47% surplus. The wettest area of the state was reported in the Western Crop Reporting District, with 85% rated in the surplus category. Growing degree day units since May 1, at 766, were ahead of the historic average by 75 units. The hot, humid days have been ideal for corn growth. However, wheat, hay, and soybean crops have not benefited as much. Statewide, corn emergence advanced to 98%, compared to 87% emerged last year and 96% for the 5-year average. The average height of emerged corn now stands at 28 inches, compared with 10 inches last year and 19 inches for the 5-year average. Overall, the corn crop was rated in 72% good or excellent condition. Soybean planting advanced to 91% complete, compared to 71% planted last year and 87% for the five-year average. 81% of soybeans have emerged, compared to 45% a year ago and 76% for the five-year average. Overall, the soybean crop was rated in 68% good or excellent condition. The soft red winter wheat crop was reported at 74% turning yellow, compared with 55% 1 year ago and 72% for the five-year average. 33% of fields were reported ripe, compared to 12% last year and 25% for the five-year average. And harvest was getting underway at 10% complete, compared to 6% for the five-year average. This has been Brad Schwab with the Illinois Field Office of the USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service in Springfield.
This is Scott Kelly with USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service in Nebraska Field Office with the Weather and Crops Report for the week ending June 13, 2010. Heavy rain halted field work during the week and caused lowland flooding in parts of central and northeast Nebraska. Rainfall totals of 5 to 6 inches were common in central and northeastern counties, with extremes of more than 10 inches reported. This delayed the finish of spring planting activities and made dry down of cut hay next to impossible. Warm, dry conditions are now needed to access fields and to improve lot conditions for feedlot animals. Statewide corn conditions rated mostly good, with 98% of the crop emerged. Producers were anxious to get post-emergence herbicides applied before corn gets too high. Soybean planting moved ahead slowly to 96% complete, and sorghum planting was at 82%. Wheat turning color was 14% and was 6 days behind average, and the first cutting of alfalfa was 65% complete. This is Scott Keller with USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service, the Nebraska Field Office in Lincoln.
And I'm Todd Gleason. You're listening to the Closing Mark Report from Illinois Public Media. It is a Tuesday afternoon. Time to check the agricultural energy markets. On the line with us is Mike Barwinski. He's with Louis Dreyfus out of Kansas City. Good afternoon to you, Mike. How are you
doing?
Good
afternoon, Todd.
Well, tell me about the ethanol marketplace.
It's been actually pretty quiet here lately. You know, there hasn't been any major disruptions in supplier demand, but we've certainly been improving from where we were in the first quarter of this year when production margins were low and there was a big oversupply in the market.
This week in St. Louis, I saw the agenda items would include how to manage, and I don't think it said how to manage your way out of an ethanol plant or through problems with an ethanol plant, but do you have any tips on how to do that?
How to lay out your ethanol plant?
Well, if you've got an ethanol plant that's struggling, what's the best thing to try to figure out how to do?
I think first of all, look at any inefficiencies that you have in your production process and where possibly, you can gain money. Logistics-wise, are you forced to sell trucks at a lower price because you haven't gotten your rail in time, or are you, how your income and outcome of income is going? Basically, is the price you're selling your ethanol gallons at really covering all of your variable costs? And if not, what price do you need to get to?
And one final question for you to think US EPA will make a decision very soon on raising the 10% blend to either 15 or 12?
Yeah, I do. I think in the next couple of months, obviously this BP spill has put some pressure on the oil industry and gives a good boost for domestically produced ethanol.
Mike, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Mike Barwinski is with Louis Dreyfus in Chicago or in Kansas City, and he joins us here on the Closing Market Report on a Tuesday afternoon. I'll return in just a couple of minutes, and we'll talk with Don Day of Day Weather out of Cheyenne, Wyoming.
It's Key West Conch Fritter Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1752, Benjamin Franklin's kite-flying experiment proved that electricity and lightning were related. He did that while flying a kite with a key attached. In 1844, Charles Goodyear received another patent for an improvement in India rubber fabrics by adding white lead to the sulfur and heating method he patented in 1839. He had spent several years since going bankrupt in hardware trying to improve natural rubber, which became sticky in summer heat and brittle in the winter. He had experimented to coat it with a powder to make it less sticky when he accidentally dropped a mixture of natural rubber and powdered sulfur on a hot stove in Woburn, Massachusetts. The heat completed the process. Despite the value of his inventions, he died in poverty in 1860. In 1851, Jacob Fussell, a Baltimore dairyman, opened the first commercial ice cream factory. At that time, the average American ate less than 1 teaspoon of ice cream a year. By the way, the first recorded reference to ice cream in the New World was found in a journal entry dated 1744. It described a dinner party at the home of Maryland's governor, Thomas Bladen, who served a dessert of ice cream made with milk and strawberries. And that's this day in agricultural history.
Support for WILL comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks by developing dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is at stuart-peterson.com.
You're listening to the Closing Mark Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. It's a Tuesday afternoon. Don Day of Day Weather out of Cheyenne, Wyoming, is here to take up the agricultural weather forecast for us. Don, please recap what happened in the last several hours and how much rainfall we had and how widespread that might have been.
WILL is a member.
It's been several small but very intense systems that have really moved through and covered a lot of territory, from East Texas to the flash flooding down in Arkansas, then all the way up north through the northern plain states and the Corn Belt and Great Lakes. But really, the coverage of the rainfall over the last week has just about gotten everybody. Amounts do vary. There's been some areas on the high end that have had as much as 4 to 7 inches of rain over the last week, and some of the heavier areas, with many areas about 1 to 3 inches. And while we do have more shower and thunderstorm activity in the forecast, I think what we're going to see is a gradual trend towards not as much shower and thunderstorm activity, and what will be temperatures that will be warming up and getting close to, if not a little, not a lot, but a little bit above normal as we get into next week.
As we move through June, Don, and into July, do you see a pattern that would continue to give us rainfall on a regular basis for that growing crop?
I do see, yes. I don't see an extended dry period coming, and I do see a day or two to where it will be dry and warmer to help folks dry out a little bit. But the chances for rain are certainly still in the forecast right on through the end of this month.
Let's move now to the hard red winter wheat growing regions of the western United States. They'll be needing to make harvest progress. Will they be slowed by rainfall at all?
I think they're going to have some good weather. Now, there are some areas that are wet, need to dry out a little bit. But right now, I don't foresee any harvest delays or anything that sticks out as a problem down there.
And then if you could move around the other side of the globe and drop in on China and check their weather for me, please.
Well, China's looking pretty moist, especially along the central and western growing areas. There's going to be some pretty active weather there. Also, some of the coastal areas are going to see some active thunderstorm activity when it comes to temperatures. Temperatures across China's growing areas close to normal, maybe a little bit below when you would expect to. When you have wet weather, you tend to have a temperature pattern like that, and that's what they're going to see.
Let's check a few other places on the planet. The monsoon season should be starting pretty soon in India, I would think.
Well, we're getting into that season where it does get started, and that's what we're definitely going to see. India looking at excellent chances for rain, and some of the western areas of India could see some heavy rainfall as that season underway there.
Hey, thanks much, Don.
Thank you.
Don Day is with Day Weather out of Cheyenne, Wyoming. If you get the opportunity, you can listen to him again. That can always happen online at willag.org. That's WILLAG.org. It's the same place that you can hear the second half hour of the Closing Market Report program we actually call The Farming World. Today on that program, we'll talk about a white paper that the Human Rights Watch organization penned on child labor practices right here in the United States. It's a good program. Hope you can stay with us for it right now on some of these radio stations. If not, you can hear it online at WILLAG.org. I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
This is the Farming World News and Interviews from the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today, we're going to talk about a Human Rights Watch article, paper, called Fields of Peril. It was authored by Zana Corson Neff. She's the Deputy Director for Human Rights Watch Children's Rights Division and joins us from New York by phone today. Thank you, Zana, for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Fields of Peril. What was Human Rights Watch wanting to look at? And it's kind of unique because this one's on agriculture in the United States.
It is. Human Rights Watch works on human rights issues around the world and about 80 countries around the world. But we also work on human rights problems in the United States. And our concern is that children working in agriculture are granted fewer protections than all other working children, and that they're working in conditions that are often far more hazardous and at far younger ages than all other working children in the United States.
Tell me about the laws in the United States that govern adolescents in the workforce and how agricultural laws are exempted or differ slightly.
Well, the U.S. child labor law is basically pretty good, except when it comes to agriculture. And then there's a huge gaping hole. Now, to be clear, I'm only talking about kids who are working for hire. I'm not talking about kids who are working for their own parents' farms. But when it comes to kids who are working for hire, in agriculture, there is no minimum age at which a child can work on a small farm with their parents' permission. They can work on any size farm at age 12 with their parents' permission, and at age 14 on any farm even without their parents' permission. By comparison, in all other work, kids can't work at least until age 14. At age 14 and 15, they can do certain jobs that aren't considered too dangerous for kids, but the hours of work are limited so that it doesn't interfere with their going to school. So you can't work more than 3 hours a day bagging groceries on a school day, for example, and on a non-school day, more than 8 hours a week being a cashier at McDonald's. But on a farm, a child can work unlimited hours outside of school with no restrictions. The other big difference is the age at which kids can do work that's considered particularly hazardous for children. And in agriculture, kids can do any job, including hazardous work, at age 16. In all other industries, kids can't do that work until they're 18 years old. So it's totally illegal for example, a 16-year-old to use a chainsaw in a lumber yard or to drive a forklift in a warehouse. But that's totally legal on a farm.
This is both the beautiful and the ugly side of being a child on the farm, and then being a child for hire for labor is maybe more the ugly side. The beautiful side is that, and I grew up in this system, is that you got to go work on the farm if your parents so desired, and I suppose depending on whether you so desired sometimes too. It's not fun to get up early in the morning and go to the bean field and walk or to work on the farm and with the livestock that early in the morning, especially as a child. But you learn a great number of things along the way, and there are reasons that there were exemptions, at least initially, so that children could work on the farm with their parents. But you're particularly worried, I think, in this study, Fields of Peril, about the children of migrant workers. Tell me the types of work that children are doing, and if I'm wrong about the target of the study too.
Well, we've looked at all kids who are working for hire, but migrant kids have an especially tough time. About 40% of all hired farm workers are migrant workers. And for migrant kids, you have the extra burden of migrating, and that means that migrant kids are often leaving school before school is actually finished, and sometimes going back to school weeks or months after school has already started. So I talked to migrant kids who said that they didn't remember a single year when they had enrolled in school on time, and kids who every year miss their final exams because they've already left to go work. And so you can imagine this has a horrific toll on their graduation rates from high school. Farm worker kids in general drop out at 3 times the national average. Most of the kids that I talked to who are migrants had been held back 1 or more times, and some said they didn't know anyone who had ever graduated from high school. So all farm worker kids are subjected or have experienced risks working on farms, but migrant kids have it especially tough. There's often serious problems with migrant housing, and so kids are not just experiencing problems in their work environment, but they may be experiencing problems in their home environment.
Yeah, to be clear, the law in the United States, as it refers to labor, differs for adults on agricultural labor as well. For instance, during the harvest and the planting season, truckers are allowed to be on the road more often than they might be because of the need to put that crop either in the bin or to get it into the ground, one of the two. So these laws are different from across the board in that scope.
Well, there are differences for all farm workers. Farm workers aren't entitled to overtime. They're exempt from some minimum wage provisions. In many states, they don't have the right to organize. And some of those gaps actually reduce family income and put more pressure on parents to send their kids to work. But when it comes to things like, you know, having no restrictions on working kids' hours in agriculture, you can have – I talked to 11-year-old kids who worked 10 or more hours a day, 12, 14 hours a day. Day at the peak of the harvest. Now, you know, that's how crops are harvested, but it doesn't mean we should have such young children working for such long hours, particularly when it takes such a toll on their health and their access to education.
You penned this article, and you have some key recommendations that you suggest for Congress. What are those?
The most important thing that can be done is to just apply the same standards that already apply to all other working kids to kids in agriculture. And that means that kids would have to be 14 years old to work for hire in agriculture. And when they're 14 and 15, have caps on the number of hours that they can work so that if they're trying to work and go to school, their schooling doesn't suffer. We should also change the law to make sure that kids aren't doing hazardous work until they're 18, because if it's too hazardous to do in any other job, it's too hazardous to do on the farm. And, you know, it's not surprising that fatality rates in agriculture are so much higher for working youth on farms than for all other sectors. They're more than 4 times higher. Now, there's a bill pending in Congress right now called the CARE Act, the Children's Act for Responsible Employment, and it has more than 92 co-sponsors in the House of Representatives, and listeners can actually call and ask their congresspeople to support this law that would provide the same protections for kids in agriculture as all other working kids already enjoy. It wouldn't keep kids from working on the farm. It would just say that the really young kids can't work, and you can't work so many hours that you put your health and education at risk.
How does the United States and laws in the United States compare to other nations around the world?
Well, like I said, I mean, a lot of our child labor laws are pretty good. The problem is this big exception for agriculture. Now, the United States is actually a leader in combating child labor around the world. The United States gives more money to combat child labor internationally than all other countries combined. It's really something outstanding about the United States. So it's a national embarrassment that we tolerate this one form of child labor that is so dangerous to kids. And we've actually gotten a lot of international criticism from the International Labor Organization for that. But, you know, we know how to fix it. It's an antiquated loophole, and we can change the law to provide the same protections for kids on farms as all other working kids.
Now, because I'm a farm boy, I understand why kids go to work on the farm or what they're doing on their own farms, their parents' farms. Why is it that child labor is used for hire in the United States? And some of that, I can remember dad hiring, you know, bean walking crews, though I have 5 brothers, so we didn't really often hire other people outside to walk beans. But why is it that child labor is hired for the detasseling crews to pick produce crops? Why does that happen?
Well, one reason kids are working at such young ages for such long hours is because it's absolutely legal. I mean, we're not going to criticize a farmer for hiring a kid when it's totally legal under the law. And the farmers have said to me, you know, if it's legal, how can I turn a child away? Because U.S. law says it's perfectly okay to send your 12-year-old to work on any large commercial farm. Kids are also working such long hours to put food on their table. You know, migrant and farm worker families are on average very poor. They tend to earn on average less than $18,000 a year for the entire family. And these kids are often really contributing to their family's income. But one reason the families are so poor is because the parents are making so little money. And I talked to so many parents who talked about being cheated out of minimum wage themselves, about not having good daycare so that they felt obliged to take their kids in the field. And a lot of parents who just said, you know, this is something we've always done. It's perfectly legal. It seems like a legitimate choice. But the truth is, you know, we don't let poor parents take their kids to a mine or to a mill and put them at risk because their families are poor. And farm kids shouldn't be exposed to those same risks.
Yes, your report says the average income would be something between $15,000 and $18,000 a year, I think, for these workers. And that there are something along the lines of 2.6 million hired hands in the United States, that'd be migrant workers, and that there are about 2.3 million teens in the workforce. That would be all teens. Do you know how many teens and or adolescents? Do you know how many child laborers there might be in agriculture?
We know that there are hundreds of thousands of children working for hire in the United States. The truth is the U.S. government doesn't count them all. But they have counted a smaller subset of all hired farm workers and come up with 211,000 kids. Now, those are just kids who are working as direct hires for farmers, not for labor contractors, and they're kids who are working on the books. And we know a lot of kids work off the books, in part because, you know, 12-year-olds don't always have checking accounts where they can cash their checks. So we know 211,000 is a low count, but you know, the government hasn't counted all these kids, and that's one of our recommendations, that we ought to know how many kids are working for hire in agriculture.
Yeah, you have some suggestions for U.S. EPA along the way too, I think, right?
Right. I mean, one of the dangers that kids face in the field is exposure to pesticides. Kids absorb pesticides more easily than adults, and they excrete them more slowly. Pesticide exposure in acute exposure can cause brain damage, coma, death. But the low-level exposure that kids are experiencing can often cause things like hormonal disruption. It's associated with cancer and other diseases. And you can imagine if a kid from a very young age is having this constant exposure in the field, they're very much at risk. And things like hormonal disruptions affect kids differently because their bodies are still developing. Now, unfortunately, the standards about farm worker exposure to pesticides set by the EPA right now are just based on an adult body. They're set on an 154-pound male as a model. They don't take into account children or pregnant women or people who are really out there in the fields. And that's really placing kids at risk. So even if farmers comply with the regulations, for example, about how long workers have to stay out of the fields after they're sprayed, there have been cases where kids have actually been acutely poisoned by pesticides because the regulations didn't take kids' bodies into account.
We're talking today with Zema Korsen-Knepp. She's the Deputy Director of Children's Rights Division at Human Rights Watch in New York, and she is the author of an article called Fields of Peril. More with her here in a moment on The Farming World.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
This is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. In business news, a San Francisco Fed economist says that U.S. Federal Reserve's exit from its ultra-low interest rate policy will take a significant period of time. Glenn Rudenbush, the Regional Central Bank's Associate Director of Research, indicated the Fed is not inclined to tighten policy anytime soon. The UN Food and Agriculture Organization today says that the rising economies of Brazil, China, and India will see strong growth in their agricultural sectors in the next decade. Russia and Ukraine will also make big gains. Brazil is predicted to experience by far the fastest growth in agriculture, an expansion of more than 40% through 2019. China and India were expected to see growth rates of 26% and 21%. The European executive has thrown its weight behind empowering new watchdogs to rein in financial speculators. The Commission, which writes the first draft of Europe's laws, issued a rough outline of new rules that recommend emergency restrictions but stop short of blanket bans on speculative bets. And Starbucks says it will begin offering unlimited free Wi-Fi at all of its company-operated U.S. locations next month. The coffee house had previously offered 2 free hours of web access each day to registered customers. Now access won't require a Starbucks loyalty card. And that's a look at today's business news.
This is the Farming World. It's a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. We're talking today with Human Rights Watch, Zema Korsun-Niff, about Fields Apparel, an article on farm labor and, in particular, child labor in the United States. When we last spoke with you, we had just brought up pesticides and exposure to pesticides that children get on the farm, especially if they're working in the fields for a very long time. You had pointed out that the risk cup in the United States, that's the amount of exposure that is allowed, is based on a male body of 154 pounds, as we closed out the first segment. But that risk cup, I know, is while it's based on 154 pounds, is for the pesticide that's being applied, the total number of times that pesticide could be applied to that crop, plus all the other pesticides and all the other times that they might be applied to that single crop in a year. So it doesn't matter whether the crop is sprayed once with the pesticide. What matters in the case of US EPA and the risk cup and the exposure that we're talking about is how many times that pesticide and all the other pesticides that are labeled for that particular crop can be sprayed in a single year. Do you not think that's good enough to cover children and women as well?
We think that risk assessment for pesticides ought to look specifically at what the effects on kids actually are. Now, there's actually something really good happening in the EPA right now, and that is they are considering this exact thing. They put out a call for public comment, and they are considering whether they should change how they assess risk to take kids into account. But we think when you're looking at the dangers of contact with pesticides, you ought to look specifically at how it affects kids and how it affects adults, because kids are affected differently.
If the child labor laws were changed to make it a 14-year-old, would you be less watchful on this particular issue? This will be a very large issue for agriculture, I know.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, blueberry farmers, for example, who have gotten a lot of scrutiny in the last year, have come out publicly and said, we don't need children in order to harvest our crops. And the U.S. Department of Agriculture has even come out and said, you know, there are so many farmers and ranchers who want to do the right thing, and no one should be exploiting kids in order to raise our food. So I actually think that there's a lot of sympathy, even among farmers themselves, for providing basic protections for kids. Because remember, this isn't about keeping teenagers from working. They'll still be able to work on farms. It just means they'll be protected from the work that's most dangerous for kids, and that really young kids won't be able to work for hire.
So what would you consider the most dangerous work for children?
Well, kids are dying from a number of things in agriculture. And remember that kids working in agriculture have a fatality rate for work that is more than four times higher than all other working kids. They're working with heavy equipment. They're working with sharp tools and machinery. They're often working in very hot temperatures. There was a teenage girl who died in 2008 from heat stroke in California after she'd been pruning grapevines for 9 hours. Agriculture can be a very dangerous place for kids. And what Human Rights Watch has said is that if a job is too dangerous outside the farm for kids, it should be too dangerous on the farm for kids. We ought to keep kids from dying at work on farms. And I think that's really something that everyone can support.
What kind of support and reaction have you had from your Fields of Peril?
Well, I think we've had, for the most part, very good support. I think Americans are shocked to realize that there is this big loophole in the law. I think a lot of people don't realize that you can legally have a 6 or 7 year old working for hire on a farm and exposed to pesticides and all the other risks. The EPA has come out and said many of our findings are sound. The Secretary of Labor has actually written to Congress and supported changing the policy that provides less protection for working kids. So I think we've had some really good support. But the thing that we really need now is for people to reach out to their congresspeople and say that they want to support the CARE bill, the Children's Act for Responsible Employment, and that they want Congress to provide the same protections for kids on farms as all other working kids.
Who are the sponsors of that bill?
It was introduced by Representative Roybal Allard, a representative in California, but it's now been sponsored by more than, I think the number now is 92 members of Congress, and there are more than 90 organizations around the United States that have gotten behind the bill and expressed their support. And that ranges from a variety of labor unions to groups like the National PTA Association, who all think this is a really important bill and time to just update our laws.
Are there any members of Congress in the Midwest or that sit on the Agriculture Committee that are sponsors of this bill?
There are, but we need more support. So if everyone can reach out to their congressperson, this is a really important time to do that. And if people want more information both about the problem for children working in the fields and what they can do to support their bill, including how to write their congressperson, they can log on to Human Rights Watch's website, which is www.hrw.org. Go to our children's rights page, and you can read the whole report. We have video information, and we have a quick and easy way you can write your congressperson.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Zayma Corson Neff. She's the Deputy Director of the Children's Rights Division for Human Rights Watch and authored the Fields of Peril article that you can find on their website at www.hrw.org. You've been listening to The Farming World. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.